Hi, I'm John Watson. Congratulations to F1 Weekly, podcast number 1,000. Hooray!
When I see something really horrible, I put my foot down, hard. Because I know that everyone else is lifting his.
What a terrible way to win.
No, there is no terrible way to win. There is only winning.
I'll be joined by Nasser Hamid, my co-host.
In the Constructors Championship, Red Bull is a runaway steam train, unbeaten so far this season with 187 points.
He's off, and he's back again. René Arnoux off the circuit and back again, and now Villeneuve's in second position, and this is the last lap.
If anybody can find traction in greasy or wet conditions, it's going to be Michael Schumacher.
Cracking start from Alonso. Look at that, he's like a missile. He's flying towards the first corner. And you see Ralf Schumacher in
off the grid. So Alonso leads from Weber, Barrichello, Raikkonen.
Welcome to F1Weekly.com. My name is Clark Rogers. I'm the host of the program. I'll be joined by Nasser Hamid, my co-host. This is podcast number 1,000, July 10th, 2023, Nasser.
Thank you, sir. I say 1,001 nights in Arabia, 1,000 nights in the palatial studios. F1 Weekly's magic carpet ride continues. Thank you for your support to all the F1 Weekly familia all over the world. And now back to Alibaba of podcasting.
Gracias, Nasser. Of course, Max wins again, ladies and gentlemen. McLaren leapfrog Aston and Merck. Daniel Ricciardo, and this is right off the wire, Daniel Ricciardo replaces De Vries, or should I say, defied. Checo just needs a home-cooked Mexican meal with extra jalapenos to get him back on track. And Jenson Button, during the Silverstone weekend, drove our favorite, the Williams FW14, the iconic F1 car, Miguel Mansell, and powered by Renault. And this week's interview, to celebrate the 1,000th podcast, we have John Watson. This is a fantastic interview. Historic. Once again, NAS hits it out of the park, and he will have all the details in the upcoming program. And of course, I must, as always, thank and ask. We need your contributions to keep this program on the air, ladies and gentlemen. Just click on the Support F1 Weekly tab. You know you want to. I want to thank Guido Myers and Thomas Hubbard and Gary Patrick for their support. Thank you, gentlemen. Keep up the good work. We love you. Nas, welcome to the festive palatial studios with the party, the champagne popping, 1,000 podcasts, Nasser. We've done it.
Well, I cannot believe. Keep up the good work to the listeners and to the host. And you know, journey of 1,000 podcasts began with first bite at Country Inn. And here we are, basically 18 years of podcasting and still counting. And like you said, in the goodie bag, we have an exclusive and extended conversation with Watty, John Watson. Now, if I remember correctly, the first podcast was in a very historic year, 2005. That was the year the Red Baron was finally shot down by Muy Macho, Hombre de España, Fernando Alonso, you are faster than Michael Schumacher. Now today he is simply El Machismo. Whether walls are crashing or messages are being texted, he is always innocent as charge.
This is Desiree for F1Weekly.com saying congratulations, felicitations on the 1,000th podcast. That's quite an achievement, especially for the host of the program, Mr. Clark Rogers. The Alpha, the Omega, the beginning and the end of F1 Weekly. Also, congratulations to co-host Nasser. I fondly remember being part of the F1 Weekly team beginning with episode number 8, I believe it was, when I did a guest spot. It led to me being a part of the podcast team, a correspondent. Our pinnacle was when we went to the U.S. Grand Prix together, and we promoted the show from there. I want to say thank you to all the people that listen to the show. We couldn't do it without you, and keep up the good work.
And, you know, just so the listeners know a little bit background, at this time, Mr. Rogers and I were strangers in the night, wondering what were the chances we'd be sharing a love for Formula One with the Global F1 Weekly Familia members 1,000 episodes later. In Formula One, no package, no delivery. Same for Palatial Studios. No listeners, no F1 Weekly. As we all know, I was homie-come lately to the show. Mr. David Tapia, the original executive producer, and I must note here, fancy titles and lots of zeros, they have been a tradition since day one. He gave the idea to the ever-humble host to start a podcast, which was a new item on the market.
Hello, all of you out there in F1 Weekly land. This is Steve Faub, former co-host of the show. I want to congratulate Clark and Nasser on getting this wonderful podcast to episode 1,000. I think I only made it to, like, I don't even know if I made it to 500. I'm so glad that they've been able to keep it going and provide you all with wonderful insight and information on this sport that we all find very fascinating and love, F1. I now live in the wonderful state of Oregon, currently camping on the Oregon coast. Hope that everyone that has ever listened to the podcast is healthy and happy. How about another 1,000, Clark? What do you say?
Mr. Rogers, I remember after our initial phone call, I got a call right back from David Tapia asking me to come and have a chat with us. We'll record your conversation and put it on the podcast. And I had to ask him, what is a podcast? So we've come a long way. So I would like to thank all our listeners for their time and support. This really means a lot to us, more than we can say. And because of time, we cannot take each and every listener, but here are some special mentions to people who have been in touch with us, people we have met, but we are thankful to everybody. Special thanks to Mr. Peter Brazier for his European support vehicle, which took us to great interview opportunities and unbelievable moments with John Surtees, Jackie Oliver, Tony Brooks, Lando Norris, Sainz Jr., and many, many more. Also to Dr. Mark, F1 Weekly's Chief Medical Officer. His Bavarian support vehicle has been very kindly made available for F1 Weekly. Also to Adrian Wood, enjoyed meeting him at Goodwood Festival of Speed a few years ago. Mr. Louis Jensen in the Netherlands sent me an email some years ago to visit Amsterdam and enjoy a lap of the 14.2-mile Nürburgring in his Stuttgart support vehicle. That experience and breakfast by the canal in Amsterdam was a total Murray Walker moment for me. It's incredible! Many thanks for that. It was nice to attend the Indy 500 with him and his wife Didi. So greets to them. And also congratulations on Max winning yet another race. Then we have Dr. Miguel in Portugalistan. He took me and arranged a lap of the track, which was very, very special because Ayrton Senna da Silva took his first victory in heavy rain in 1985 at this track. And of course, that's Estoril in Portugal. And boy, do I remember that performance at 5 in the morning in San Jose, California. I think he lapped all the drivers except the person who finished second. Shout out also goes out to Monsieur Portinier in Switzerland. And we have F1 Weekly family members south of the border also share their love with us. Senor Eduardo and I took a trip to Autodromo Hermanos Rodriguez in Mexico. So that was a very special trip. There was a trip to Interlagos also with Senor Lou Bartella and Miss Heisa. Hola to them. And I spent a couple of days there and that was very, very nice. And hopefully, one of these days, I will make another run to Brazil 66. Here in the U.S., shout-out goes to longtime listeners like Christy Hardy, and I see him regularly at races. Tech Talk Tim, a fellow purveyor of not only Formula One, but also Persian food. We used to get together when I was in Cali, and he was studying at Stanford, so good times. Gregory Goditis, meeting him at Daytona in January is an annual event now. Philip Pegler on the left coast, not too far from the palatial coast. Shout out to him as we wait for the next Pegler's perspective. Doug Keklak is another long-time listener. He sent a message saying, "It's an amazing accomplishment when you look at the podcast on all topics that have come and gone in the time frame you and Clark have been at it. Thanks so much for so many hours of entertainment." So many thanks to Doug. If all goes well, Mr. Rogers, now that I have time on hand, a trip to Watkins Glen is planned in the next few weeks with Senor Pasquale and Toby Dawes, both in New York State, and Toby is also the high-paid webmaster of F1 Weekly. A shout-out to longtime ANZ core, the original JB, Mr. Jason Bentley, Mr. Balraj Dhaliwal, and Mr. Goodacre, where are you? Shout-out also to Loosh on the Loose, and he has been a very long time and very seriously dedicated listener, and we stay in touch, so I appreciate that. Garrett in New Zealand, he was at Spa in 2013 with the F1 entourage for the Grand Prix and some Stella Artois and Jupiler. Thanks to all our listeners for their support, even the occasional digital slings and arrows, which have not slowed down. They are very much appreciated. Anything you want to say, Senor Rogers?
Well, yeah, I mean, there are so many people to thank, but really, to make this all happen, you had to have some heavy-duty, rock-steady people behind the scenes, and that's Toby Dawes. Toby Dawes, I don't even know how he found us, because let me put it this way, F1 Weekly doesn't pay Google anything. We don't come up on the search engines very quickly. But Toby Dawes found us when we had made our own website, really just copying a bunch of Renault colors and a little machismo on the top. And Toby found this website, of course, felt sorry for these fools, but he loved F1, and he thought that it was time well spent to help these idiots over on the West Coast while he's on the East Coast. And without him, the website would still look like Renault's website. I mean, so he's done everything for us. He gets the biggest thanks from me because, like Nasser said, of course he's highly paid, lots of zeros. And, you know, he knows we're a bunch of poor people and he's helping us look fantastic on the web. So, and not only that, but I mean, without him, number 455 would still be stuck in the cache. So he helps us out all the time when we have technical difficulties, never complains. He's always right there and he always fixes it. Toby, we tip our hat off to you. He is the greatest webmaster in the world. And of course, there's so many other people. San Jose Label, they made the first F1 Weekly stickers. They were one of our first recorded sponsors. Awesome stuff. And Desiree did so much. The Winds of Barcelona. If you could remember those old podcasts, we were hilarious.
Are you in business and want to make a hard-hitting visual impact that gets your name and message promoted? F1 Weekly knows from experience that the creative team of Caton Designs are graphic design geniuses and a company that can give your brand a visual pop in a cost-effective way. Contact Caton Designs at catondesigns.com for visual messaging solutions that get your business image seen.
And Steve Fahm and David Tapia for suggesting to do a podcast. Who would have thought? It's a lot of great memories. And the big bonus on top of this is Fernando is still driving an F1. So I'm jubilant.
Yes, sir. And my thanks to Toby Dawes also. It's just, speaking of the OR website, I hope you don't mind sharing this with the members of the F1 Weekly Familia. Clark and I, we were at the Indianapolis Holiday Inn for the U.S. Grand Prix, and I mentioned the website, and Mr. Rogers went ballistic. Do you remember that moment, Mr. Rogers?
I did. Hey, have you seen that website lately?
No, but I do remember how hurt you were, and I really felt very bad. But it was constructive criticism. It was not something I was trying to make fun of. We have some unfinished business. Suzuka and Albert Park Hopefully, time and health permitting, we shall enjoy some Vegemite sandwich soon with our familiar members in Land Down Under in March, and that is the plan. So we'll see how things work out. And sir, without further ado, I think we should treat our listeners to our goodie bag to celebrate the 1,000 podcast. Is that okay with you?
Absolutely. This is a great conversation. I get to listen to these things. I'm privy to some really fantastic historical data here. And John Wonson, he totally delivers. I mean, you cannot stop listening to this. So we have you.
Yeah, you know, I met John first time at the 2019 Abu Dhabi Grand Prix, and I asked him, you know, do you remember what happened in the 1977 French Grand Prix at Dijon-Prenois? And he said, oh, yeah, so many years ago, and people still talk about it. And then we were supposed to meet, and COVID got in the way, and I was in Detroit, and I get a text message from Pedro Rogers saying John Watson is in Detroit. So I reached out to him, and that's where I met him. He was invited by Roger Penske in 1976. What he gave captain his only Grand Prix win in Austria, and also won the inaugural Detroit F1 Grand Prix in 1982. So this was a great opportunity. I am very thankful for his time, and also for staying in touch with me during these 3 years when we were trying to sort something out. I am also very thankful to Merrill Kane of Penske Racing. He was instrumental in putting me in touch with John Watson. So many thanks to Merrill and Mr. Watson. So please enjoy this conversation with Mr. John Watson. Okay, folks, I'm here in Detroit, and a great pleasure and honor to meet Mr. John Watson. John, good to see you again. How are you?
Thank you very much. I'm very well indeed. I'm having a lovely time here in Detroit, returning after 40 years, and it's actually 41 years since I won the inaugural Detroit Formula One Grand Prix in 1982. So I was invited by Penske, through the Penske team, to come out and be here. Part of my background obviously was winning Roger's Grand Prix in 1976 in Austria. So there's a synergy, and I was invited to become the Grand Marshal for the event. So it's been wonderful coming back to Detroit. It's been 40 years since I was last here. So to come back to one of my five Formula One wins, and winning here in 82 was a pretty special race for me. It was one of those days when everything was just totally magical. And you know, when I came into the circuit on Thursday, and I realized this is not a million miles different from when I raced here 40 years ago, 41 years ago.
Now, that race was the inaugural race, and a great win. You came from 17th on the grid. What do you remember most from that race and passing three cars on one lap?
Well, the race started, and I think after about five or six laps, I think Riccardo Patrese went off in turn one and into the tire barrier, and they had to remove all that, clear it all up. So the race was red flagged. So we went back into pit lane. And when I was in pit lane, so sitting in the car waiting for things to get back underway, Pierre Dupasquier, who was the Michelin tire competition manager, came and said, John, put on the 05 compound. Michelin had two basic race tires. One was 06, the other was 05. There was not very much difference, but the 05 was one that I tended to suit. It was slightly more durable. So Pierre said, put the 05 on. He said, you'll win the race. He must be. Anyway, eventually I spoke to the guys on the car. I said, look, Dupasquier says put on the 05, so the guys put on the 05s. Race recommenced, and then for some reason my car came alive, and I had more grip, more speed than any single car in that race. And when I was chasing down Keke Rosberg, who was leading, Keke was getting pit signals, Watson plus 15, Watson plus 12, Watson plus 10, and poor Keke had done his fastest race laps, and I was still taking 2-3 seconds a lap out of him. He didn't know what was going on. So I caught and passed Keke to get into the lead, but what I hadn't realized is that because it was a two-part race, the positions at red flag and then at restart meant that I still had to drive to offset the difference in time. So eventually I got ahead of them both on the road and in eclipsed time and won the race.
And the championship went to the season finale in Las Vegas, and you had a chance to win the championship. How do you reflect on that season, and was it a real big letdown not winning the championship?
Look, 82 was a very unusual year. At the start of the year, there could have been 10 or 12 drivers potentially could win the championship. In reality, Ferrari drivers, one or the other, Villeneuve or Pironi, ought to have been the world champion, but tragically Villeneuve died, and then Didier got involved in an unnecessary accident at Hockenheim in a wet session, so both Ferrari drivers were eliminated. And then it came down to Keke Rosberg had been very good, very consistent throughout the season, and had built up points. Went to Las Vegas, and I was probably the best placed of anybody else in that race to win the championship. But I needed to win the race, and Keke had to finish fifth or lower. So I finished second to Michele Alboreto, and Keke finished in fifth place, and he won the championship. But in reality, I suppose you look back and reflect, and I could have done some things better, and the team could have done some things better. So it's a championship over a season, and you have to be reflective and honest about why did we not win that championship. I mean, it would have been a wonderful fulfillment of my life and my career to have been a world champion. I didn't win the championship, Keke did, and that's the difference between winning and not winning.
Well, a lot of people, myself included, think of you as a champion. I have a question from that season in 1982 San Marino Grand Prix. A lot has been said and written about the race between the two Ferrari drivers. As a Grand Prix driver yourself, what was your take on what happened there?
Well, I think, Ferrari ran a company where they encouraged competition between the drivers. That goes back to Enzo Ferrari in his early days. So that was something which is not unusual in Ferrari. But I suspect the events that occurred at Imola, and I think Villeneuve felt that there had been a betrayal of honour between the two drivers. And I also feel that it was handled badly by the management in Ferrari. They could have handled it better, in my opinion, but unfortunately it was allowed to unfold. And Gilles left Imola with a very, I think, bitter taste in his mouth. And then we went to Zolder for the Belgian Grand Prix, and I think at the point Pironi had maybe secured provisional pole position, and Gilles wanted to go out and try and wrestle that position away from Pironi, and came across Jochen Mass, who was going slowly, and Jochen saw the Ferrari coming, and he tried to help, but the closing speed of the Ferrari over the arrows resulted in a collision, and as a result of that, Villeneuve tragically lost his life. It was certainly, in my opinion, an incident that could have been avoided, and I think what would have been required was Villeneuve to back out of it, because he couldn't control what Jochen Mass was doing, but he could control what he was doing. And unfortunately, sometimes everybody is guilty of making judgments which can have consequences, and that was a situation where the consequences proved fatal.
Now, today we have a new sheriff in town in IndyCar racing, and you are the man, like you said, who gave him his only victory in Formula One. Please tell our listeners about the 76 Austrian Grand Prix. Can you describe the emotions of the team and driver because of the circumstances at the same race previous year?
Well, I got a drive with Roger Penske and the Penske team in Formula One following the tragic accident that occurred in the Austrian Grand Prix in 75, when Mark Donohue had gone off in the Sunday morning warm-up and he was struck by a catch fence pole and he passed away the day later. So I joined the team then for the full season, the full 1976 season. And we had a car called the Penske PC3 that was then superseded by the Penske PC4. And by the time we got to Austria, the PC4 was a very, very good car. But it was again a race. A lot of memories in the Penske team going back 1 year later. And certainly for Roger and for Heinzhofer and for other key members of the team, they would have been reflecting on what had occurred a year earlier. Remember, Mark Donohue was the talisman of the Roger Penske racing operations all the way through the 60s and the 70s. So to go back to the event where 1 year later Mark had passed away, I've no doubt had there were private moments for all the people that were involved. But the Grand Prix got underway, and we started on a racetrack that was part damp, part dry. So there's a lot of shifting around of positions, but eventually I find myself in the lead of the race, and the car was fantastic, did a brilliant job all the way through, and I managed to bring the car home and win a Grand Prix, and it was my first Grand Prix win, but more importantly it was Roger Penske's team's first Grand Prix win. And to this day there is no other American Formula One entrant, and there haven't been too many in fairness, but Roger still holds that record as being the last American Grand Prix entrant to win a Grand Prix, a World Championship Grand Prix. So I know Roger's very proud of it. I'm equally proud of my contribution, and in part, indirectly, that's what the synergy of me being here this weekend.
The morning after the race, you had a new look. The beard was gone, and Roger had difficulty in recognizing you at breakfast.
Yeah, I mean, when I signed for Roger, I had a beard.
Remember that.
Yeah. And I know that the image that Roger's team had was a very Ivy League, clean-cut image. So Roger at no point ever suggested I should shave the beard. But I sensed that, look, actually, you know what? I personally, I'd wanted to get rid of the damn thing. So rather than doing it at the start of the season and Roger told you to get rid of it, none of that ever arose. I said, when we win a Grand Prix, I promise you I will shave the beard. So flew back to London on Sunday evening. We were staying in a hotel at Heathrow because Roger was returning to over here to America on Monday morning. I went up to my hotel room, went into the bathroom, got out my razor, and I shaved my beard. And it was quite a full beard at that time. And when I hadn't seen my face for 8 years. When I saw it, like, oh my, I mean, I should have put it back on again. But anyway, I went to bed, got up in the morning. I was down in the coffee shop before Heinz and Roger turned up. And I remember Roger coming in and saying to Heinz, hey, Heinz, where's Watson? Where's Watson? And I was sitting over in a corner. I said, Roger, I'm over here. And he looked around because he heard the voice and he knew the voice, but he hadn't recognized me. And I think he was maybe surprised that I had so quickly shaved the beard. So it was a little moment of a private moment for all of us, and a moment we could all have a laugh about. And I've had a look at a beard subsequently, but when it's at my age now, it's pure white. Not a good look at my age to have a pure white beard.
Now, you mentioned Heinz Hofer. He was the manager of his Formula One team. What a sad event it was after he came to your place for dinner.
Yes, I mean, Heinz was, I think, one of the finest people I'd ever worked with on a daily basis. We became really good friends. And you know, when Roger then pulled out of Formula One, Heinz stepped in and immediately to try and assist me get a seat elsewhere. And all the way through the 77 season, because Heinz was based still down in Poole and Dorset. And in fact, the team invited me to come out to Indianapolis in 77 to see the Indy 500. And at the back end of the year, Heinz had gotten engaged. And he was going to get married to a lovely girl called Linda. And he came over to my house that evening, and we had supper and went back. And when he left my house to go back to Poole, I don't know what happened, but somehow or other, there was a dual carriageway around Chichester, which is near to where I was living. And somehow or other, Heinz got onto the eastbound carriageway going westward. And he was involved in a head-on collision with another car, tragically. And Heinz was killed, and I think the passenger in the car also was killed, and the driver was quite badly injured. It was horrible, horrible for everybody involved. There was nothing about it that you could say was just other than horrible. And I lost a very, very good friend. Roger lost a key member of his race team, and the other car with the passenger, they lost family members as well. So it was a really, really awful moment. It's just one that nothing more I can say about it.
Okay, Formula One has become a very elite club. Lewis calls it BBC Billionaire Boys Club, very rightly so. But 9-year-old John Watson was in the paddock at Dundalk. What was the feeling like hanging out next to legends like Fangio, Moss and Hawthorne?
Well, I grew up in Northern Ireland, and we have had a number of very, I think, great what I would call proper road circuits. These are public roads. Detroit is a street track, but these were public roads, and there was one in particular called Dundrod, which was about 10 miles outside Belfast. And it was always very weather affected. But the 1955 Tourist Trophy event, which was part of the Sports Car World Championship, and all the major manufacturers, Mercedes, Ferrari, Jaguar, Aston Martin, Maserati, and then Porsche, Lotus, Cooper, all the way down through the different categories. And my father was racing at that time in Ireland, and we were very friendly with one driver called Ron Flockhart, who was a great driver of that era. And I think in that race he was driving for MG. So we were in the paddock at Dundrod, and I saw the 300 SLRs. I saw the 300 SLR Coupe, the car that got sold. The factory sold one of those for about $150 million, I gather. And, you know, Fangio was there, Stirling Moss and the Mercedes, John Finch, I think, was one of the... I think John Finch might have been there as well, an American driver who was drove for the factory Mercedes team. I mean, every driver of international repute was there, and as a nine-year-old, to sort of see people that I'd only ever read about, and, you know, to see them, more to see them in person in the paddock. And I remember getting Mike Hawthorne's autograph. Mike Hawthorne was driving the Jaguar, which was probably considered to be the principal challenger to Mercedes. And Mike Hawthorne was sharing his car with a driver from Northern Ireland, a very fine race driver called Desmond Titterington. And Mike and Desmond took the challenge of that race to Mercedes, and the Jaguar, when Mike was driving it, I think retired near the end. I think they had a failure of some description, and Mercedes went on, and Stirling won the race. I mean, a fantastic race. And when, I've been very fortunate a number of years ago when Mercedes had a celebrity car deal. And we were taken to Mercedes factory, and we went to the test track at Untertürkheim, and I got to drive a 300 SLR Mercedes. And I mean, what a fantastic race car that was. I mean, what a privilege to be allowed to get behind a priceless piece of Mercedes-Benz racing history.
Yes. Now, Easter Monday, 1969, Thruxton. This was the beginning of the legend of coming from behind. What was that experience like against Grand Prix greats in a Formula 2 race?
A colleague in Ireland called Gerry Kinane had bought two Lotus 48s, the same car that Jim Clark lost his life tragically in Hockenheim. And Gerry entered them for the Formula 2. It was the Easter weekend in 1969 at Thruxton. So I'd never driven the car until I got to Thruxton. I'd never driven a car with that type of aerodynamics on it. And in the race, suddenly everything seemed to come together, and I found myself catching and overtaking drivers. I thought, well, I can't. I mean, I was pinching myself, thinking, well, I've come from a small country where there's very good racing, but not at this level. And here was I catching Francois Xavier, Regazzoni, and I can't remember who else, and overtaking them as if there were just no problem whatsoever. And what it did, it opened a Pandora's box in my life. It made me appreciate that actually I was good enough, I had enough ability to be able to compete on a level playing field with drivers who were the acknowledged and recognised, you know, superstars of the day. And it was, you know, a moment where it transformed my life. And I was then very lucky to have two parents who realised that if you want to lance the boil, you've got to give our son the chance to go out and do what his dream has been. And they gave me that opportunity. So in 1970, we bought a Formula 2 Brabham. And again, one year later at Thruxton, in my heat in the Formula 2 race, the front row of the grid was pole position Jochen Rindt. Beside him, Jackie Eakes. And I was the third car in that front row of the grid. I mean, again, you have to pinch yourself to think I'm in the company of two legends of motorsport.
Yes. Now, 1970 at Rouen, you had a very bad accident, but still very lucky based on what happened that weekend. Can you talk about the risk involved in those days, and was there ever any concern or pressure from your family to quit racing?
Well, I mean, if I look back to 1970 or that era, I mean, what happened at Rouen was I didn't realize, but I had a tire or rear tire was deflating, and I went through a really fast high speed corner, and the sidewall of the tire broke away from the bead of the rim, and it just went into a high speed spin, and it hit the barrier one side across and hit the barrier on the other side. So I suffered, you know, okay, there weren't life threatening injuries, but there were injuries that took me out of racing. At that time, I didn't think I was racing in a dangerous era, because the cars we raced and the circuits we raced on were considered to be the cutting edge of the available technology at that time. Now, if I think back, 53 years to what I was doing, and I look at the race car, a tube frame Formula 2 Brabham, and you look at the safety around the circuit, Rouen was one of the classic, again, a road circuit. And, I mean, there are images of Fangio in particular in the French Grand Prix 1957 coming down the hill, down to the bottom of the circuit. Power sliding a 250F mile. I mean, just iconic images. And I loved the circuit. I thought it was a fantastic circuit. But it bit me because of what happened with the tire. So, look, you can really reflect on how it was at the time and not analyze it and say, well, if I was in a car with 2023 technology, if I was in one of those cars, I'd have jumped out of the car and walked away. That's where Formula 1 and Formula 2 has progressed, and same with your Indy cars. I mean, you saw shunts at Indy last weekend, 220-30 miles an hour, turn 1, turn 3. That's going to hurt if you hit it. But the technology and the manufacturing and the science of what goes into contemporary motor racing and design of cars is space-age technology compared to where we were 53 years ago.
Now, speaking of shunts, we had one on your championship debut at Silverstone in 1973. Jody Scheckter got all the headlines. How do you remember this race, especially the opening lap? Were you caught up in the melee?
Well, 73 at Silverstone British Grand Prix, it was my first World Championship Grand Prix, and I was driving a Brabham, which was sponsored by a team I would then go on to drive for in 1974, a company in London called Hexagon of Highgate. They were motor dealers, and they came to an agreement with Bernie Eccleston to lease the car for the race. But we were, you know, a private team. We didn't get all the perks and benefits of, let's say, the options tire-wise that were available. But I started towards the back of the field, and by the time I got to Woodcote Corner where the incident had occurred, the marshals were very energetically waving the flags to slow down. So I was able to slow down, and I could thread my way through. It was like an aircraft accident. There was about 16 or 18 cars involved. You could barely see the racetrack for bits of cars, whatever. So the race obviously had to be stopped, and everything was eventually cleared up, and we restarted. And, I mean, I did my job, but retired in the race. But I know that when the sort of the facts and figures came out, at the point at which I then retired, I had set the sixth quickest lap in the race. So I felt that's not bad for a small private team. You're running on a shoestring and not getting all the perks and benefits that, you know, a full-on factory team would get.
Now, Monaco 1977, first pole position for you. Did you enjoy racing on street circuits as compared to the original high-speed Silverstone and Oosterreifing?
Yeah, I mean, look, street tracks have always been a part. I mean, I've raced on street tracks, or road circuits, let's call them that, more than the street tracks, when I was racing in Ireland, because there was a number of tracks that I would race on. There was always something about racing on a street track which I enjoyed, which is, it was about precision, because there is no margin for error on a street track. And, I mean, one of the things I bemoan today on permanent racetracks, especially in Formula One, is the amount of space on the exit of a corner, and what I call the abuse of track limits. You know, going back to the early 70s, that didn't exist. Track limits were very much demarcated. So if you put two wheels off the side of the racetrack, you could be in trouble. Today it's different. I mean, everything is different. But the joy of racing on a street track is, I felt, about accuracy and precision, placing your car, knowing how close you can run up against a barrier or a concrete wall, and just skim it but not hit it. And there's a lot of satisfaction in fulfilling that aspect of your particular skill.
Okay, this next race I remember very well, the 1977 French Grand Prix at Dijon-Prenois. Can you share with us what you said to Carlo Kitty and the Brabham team after you lost a certain win on the final lap?
I mean,
I'm assuming you were not thrilled.
Well, I mean, that was a great race, particularly between Mario Andretti and myself, and it's been described as a battle of David and Goliath. I was Goliath in the Brabham Alpha, and Mario was David in the Lotus 78. So I was quicker in some parts of the track, Mario was quicker in the other, and we had a race for maybe half the race distance, but I'd always been able to maintain the advantage. But on the final lap at the far end of the racetrack, there was an uphill hairpin bend, and as I entered the hairpin, all of a sudden the engine went, and it was a fuel starvation. And of course Mario didn't need a second invitation, so he was able to pull up and get ahead of me, and he won the race and I came second. I don't know to this day what really was the cause, whether it was maybe we used more fuel in the race or whether we didn't put enough fuel in at the beginning, I don't know. But the outcome was the same. We should have won that race, and I would have been... I mean, I loved Alfa Romeo and I loved Brabham, and I mean I still love Alfa Romeo to this day. I think they're a fantastic brand, but I mean, it was a disappointment to me and a disappointment to the team.
Carlo Kitty was quite a character. How did you find working with him?
Well, engineer Kitty was one of those legends of motor racing from the 50s and 60s, and he was one of those, if you like to call them, geniuses that Italy produces. But he was at that point, probably not as directly involved, but he was the head of Autodelta, the company that was responsible for the manufacturer, design and manufacture of the Alfa Romeo flat 12 Formula 1 engine. And he was just a very nice gentleman. I would have dealt more with his lieutenants on a daily basis, but engineer Keaty would come to a race and he would sit and observe. And yeah, he was just a really nice man.
How sweet was winning the 1981 British Grand Prix and giving John Barnard and McLaren first victory for a carbon fiber car?
Silverstone 81 came after two previous races, the French Grand Prix at Dijon again, where I finished second, and the Spanish Grand Prix earlier at Jarama, just outside Madrid, where I came third. Silverstone wasn't a circuit that at natural pace we would have expected to win, but what happened on that day was a number of events, one of which was Villeneuve having a major moment in the middle of the chicane, which took out Alan Jones, and I managed to avoid, but my engine stalled, so I managed to have enough momentum to kick start, and so I had to, people I'd already overtaken had gone past, and then I had to retake them. And towards the end of the race, the two Renaults, Alain Prost, had an issue and he retired. René Arnoux, who then was leading, was losing power. So I was able to catch Arnoux and overtook him. And I remember coming down Hangar Straight, and I could see that down at Stowe Corner, there was suddenly the public, the crowds were standing up and cheering. But I was cognizant of what had happened at Dijon in 77. I was leading the Grand Prix. I had no challenger near to me, but I knew I had to keep my concentration and focus and not let all that was around the racetrack, you know, distract me. And eventually, as the laps counted down, we got to the final lap, and I was just hoping and praying that nothing would happen on the final lap. Took the checkered flag and we won the race. And it was a seminal moment for McLaren, but principally for Ron Dennis and John Barnard, who had been incorporated into the McLaren team a year and a bit earlier. Well, actually, it was 6-9 months earlier. And the reason that they were brought into the team was to take McLaren from where it had been into the new era of aerodynamics. And it was a very important day in the life of Ron Dennis and John Barnard, because it consolidated the concept of a carbon fiber chassis Formula One car, which John Barnard pioneered. And that monocoque was actually made over in a company called the Hercules Corporation, over in Salt Lake City in Nevada. So there was a lot of elements came together which contributed to that success on that particular weekend.
Now, McLaren asked you to evaluate two young drivers they were interested in, Kevin Cogan, yep, and Alain Prost. You were quoted as saying Kevin was all over the place and Alain was so comfortable in the car like he was born in it. What made him so adaptable and quick?
Well, Kevin was the choice of McLaren, and Alain was the choice of Philip Morris Marlboro. Kevin went out first, and from my memory, and he didn't seem to have the same, I would say, inherent feel that Alain Prost had. When Alain got into the car, drove down the pit lane, and I looked, I said to whoever it was, Teddy Mayer, I said, look, he's born to this. Everything was done just on a lovely, continuous, perfect. And it was very quickly apparent that Alain was going to be the option that the team were going to go down. And Alain was outstanding in his first season. And we worked very well. I mean, I treated him as like my little baby brother. And that's what I felt, you know, and even though he was my competition, and it was 1980 was not an easy year for me in the team. The team were having to battle not only the competition on the racetrack, but there was also the John Barnard, Ron Dennis thing was in the background, and Teddy and McLaren Engineering were trying to use all their technology to basically to prevent it happening. And they saw Alain as being their talisman, and he got the full attention of the team. And I was somewhat, I would say, neglected, which I felt was a shame because it was, to me, it was disrespectful. But at the end of the year, I got all the bits and pieces that Alain had had, and McLaren had then produced another chassis called the M30, which really they were no further down the road. And I had the M29. And the thing that I got with the M29 was in the final two races, I had the attention of John Barnard, who joined McLaren in the final two races, and John then engineered my car. And he made some fundamental changes to the aerodynamic, and he transformed the car. And Alain was running around in the M30 going nowhere, and I was way, way quicker than he was. And all of a sudden, John actually can race a Formula One car, but he'd forgotten he can drive a car. And that's the reason why the team retained me then for 1981.
Now, after the 83 season, is it true you lost your McLaren drive to Alain Prost because the professor was a little naughty at Renault?
So, the whole end of 1983, South Africa, flying home Saturday night, and somebody from the team said, well, I suppose we're going to have to talk to you about driving for next season. I said, absolutely, let's bring it on, do it now. So, got back on Sunday. On Monday, I got a call from Niki Lauda. He said, be careful. Alain is looking to get your seat. What can I do? He said, well, I'm just advising you. And Niki didn't want Alain, because he knew Alain would be a bigger handful than I am. And the reality was, Alain had been, he returned to Paris on the Sunday, and he'd been summoned to come to the Renault headquarters in Paris, and he was fired. And I don't know the truth of why he was fired, whether it was reasons that, I don't know. It's never been made public, just he was fired. And on the Sunday evening, he called Philip Morris Marlboro to say, look, I've been fired. Is there a seat available for me at Ferrari? Because Alain had been in a turbocharged Renault. He didn't want to go back to a Cosworth engine car. So he was told, no, the Ferrari seats are blocked, but there's a seat available at McLaren. And from what I understand, Alain said, well, you've got Niki and John. And the response was, Niki is under contract for 1984. John's out of contract. We want to speak to you. And frankly, it was a no-brainer. Because Alain was going to be the future. Niki and I were senior drivers, and at any time, we both of us, or one of us, could turn around and say, look, we're stopping. And that would have meant that McLaren would have had to go out and secure another driver, a top driver, at the top of the market. And Alain came along at a bargain basement price. So they got two good. One was he was available basically for nothing, and secondly, he was the future. You know, a young driver who's going to be a future world champion, and he would be at McLaren for 3, 4, 5 years.
Speaking of future, now we have Max Factor. Looks like he was born with a steering wheel between karting and Formula One, only one season of Formula Three, and he won more races than the championship winner. How do you rate him among the very best and fastest you have seen in motor racing?
So Max is one of those wunderkinds that come into motorsport from time to time. And of course his father was a great racing driver and he had all the associations. But that doesn't mean Max is going to be a great driver. I mean, Max is one of those drivers who is, you know, unbelievably fast. In his early Formula One career, I think he took a lot of very high risk chances. He won races, but he, you know, sometimes got involved in issues. Biggest one, of course, was Silverstone 2021 with Lewis Hamilton. And I think that that was an avoidable situation, but that's Max. Is such a competitive and driven personality that he was not going to allow Lewis any room whatsoever, and the contact took place. And anyway, so since he's won his first championship, there's been a transformation in Max. He doesn't need to drive in the manner that he sometimes did do in his earlier days, and he won a second championship 2022, and he's going to win a third championship this year. And he's now, I think, that aggressive edge that he had, I think, is now beginning to round off. And he knows he's in that purple patch in his life and his career. And he's got a fantastic car and he's got a fantastic team around him. And he can continue in the current format that Formula One is in for as long as he wants. And he's probably going to continue winning because there's no consistently competitive team or competitor there to challenge him. I mean, I would love it to be Fernando Alonso, because I love Fernando Alonso. But Mercedes are going through difficulties, Ferrari are going through their issues, and there's only really three top teams, and Aston Martin's, you know, it's a doppelganger sort of catching up to those three top teams.
One of your team bosses was Teddy Mayer, a lawyer from Pennsylvania, known as Wiener in motor racing. How did you find him as a team boss? Did you like working with him?
I got on well with Teddy. I mean, other than I mentioned, the 1980 season was a difficult season. And I think that there were issues which arose in 80 wherein I felt I was not treated well. I know the reasons probably why, because the team and Teddy would have been fighting to secure their own team and the ownership of the team. Oh, here we go. Indy Lights down into turn three. So, okay, I can say that I felt the treatment I got was not good, and ultimately that responsibility lies at the head of a company. But subsequently, in 81, 82, Teddy was working with me, and in 82 in particular, Teddy was a very good race engineer, and he actually understood what I wanted. Sometimes, maybe the way I explained things wasn't as good as it could have been, but he understood what I wanted, and he knew if I was given a car that I could drive, that I could be very quick and very effective. And I've got a lot of time for Teddy. And of course then when he left at the end of 82, and he ended up joining Roger Penske and working for the Penske Corporation.
I remember. Now, Roger Penske and Ron Dennis, both uberly successful team owners. Similarities and differences between the two?
Well, in many respects, there are a lot of similarities. I think when Roger came in, and the way that Roger's team has always been presented, the presentational sides of the teams have always been outstanding. Roger's always employed extremely good people, you know, technical people, engineering. So that would be an example. Now, whether Ron consciously looked at what Roger was doing, because Ron had his own ideas, and Ron, you know, from an early age, was very clear in what he wanted his team to achieve. And one of the things that Ron, I remember making very clear, is there is no such thing as bad luck. And what Ron believed is that everything is, there's a reason behind it. You say bad luck because you had an engine failure. Well, that's not bad luck, that's an engine failure. So what do we have to do to ensure we don't have engine failures in the future? And he said about a course of action. Or if it was bad driving, it wasn't bad luck, it was bad driving. So that would be certainly where Ron, and I don't know about Roger now, because going back to 76 is a long way back. But certainly in Ron's era, he had visions of what he needed his team to do. and he put into place mechanisms, engineering ones, personal ones, every area he covered. But fundamentally, they're very similar in what their desires were.
Now, a couple of questions about two teammates. Moko, also known as Carlos Pache, was your teammate at Brabham. How quick was he, and why was his wife called Miss American Express?
Okay, I mean, I don't know about Miss American Express, but I mean, Carlos Pache was a lovely guy, a very, very good Brazilian Formula One driver. And when I joined Brabham in 77, Carlos was the incumbent, and he was loved by the team and loved by Bernie. Bernie was very good friends with Carlos, and his wife was, I forget her name. But listen, you're going back to a time when you're talking about the middle 70s. A different era, and the image, if you wish, or how Formula One drivers appeared, it wasn't less professional, but it was certainly a lot different to where we would be, let's say, today. And Carlos and Bernie and the wives, they would go out and have dinner and have a lot of laughter. And the weekend that Carlos died was the weekend of the Race of Champions at Brands Hatch. I came into the circuit on Sunday morning, and it was advised that Carlos had died in a plane accident. I know Bernie was extremely upset, as were the team. And they lost somebody who they really enjoyed working with. And Carlos was a very good race driver. He was a very quick guy. They would have said he could have been a world champion at Brabham.
One driver also we miss much, Stefan Beloff. You won a sports car race with him. How did you rate him?
Stefan Beloff would be one of those totally natural race drivers. Enormous natural speed. Could get into a race car and just go out and dial it in straight away. Straight on it. He didn't overanalyze it. He just had a huge natural ability and talent. And that was a tragic waste of life. I mean, he lost his life in an incident at Spa, which should never have arisen. And it was tragic, absolutely tragic.
Hey, George, your commentary when you were doing for A1GP, looks like the series is coming back and now you're working in GT Racing. Can you tell our listeners a little bit about a day in the life of John Watson these days?
Well, my life is very straightforward. I'm 77. And I work in a broadcast of a race series run by Stefan Rattel organization, which runs the largest GT3 championships in the world. And it's really, really great racing. I mean, you've got road cars modified for racing, as you've got them here this weekend. GT3s, GT4s, GT2s. And you've got a diversity of entrants. And the big thing that makes the championship work is that there's a formula called balance of performance, wherein every car's performance is measured against everybody else's. So no one manufacturer or brand has got an advantage, which means that no brand is dominating. And domination in motorsport is not always the healthy thing. I mean, it's great for that. You've got Red Bull dominating Formula One. You've had Ferrari dominating Formula One. You've had Mercedes dominating Formula. It's great for those people, but it's not necessarily the best thing for those championships. And I think the championship I work in, you know, generates really good motor racing. It's entertaining. You've got very sexy cars. And, you know, no one driver car package dominates.
And thank you so much for your time. It's great to meet you.
John, thanks for joining F1Weekly.com. Back to you, Nasser.
Hi, I'm world champion Jacques Villeneuve. Congratulations to F1 Weekly on 1,000 podcast.
Fantastic interview, Nas. Keep up the good work. After that, I need a break, so we'll be back after these brief messages.
Hi, I'm Giancarlo Fisichella, and you are listening F1 Weekly.
Hi, I'm David Coulthard, otherwise known as DC, and you're listening to F1 Weekly.
Hi, this is Mika Häkkinen, double Formula One world champion. All the best for the readers, F1 Weekly.
Hello, I'm Jean Lizy, and you are listening F1 Weekly.
I am René Anou, and you must to listen like me, F1 Weekly.
Welcome back to F1Weekly.com. Clark Rogers here, your host. In now, as we spin the globe and go around the world with Motorsports Mondial, with the king, the Sultan himself, Nasser Hamid.
Thank you.
Thank you, sir. British Grand Prix, Silverstone, the birthplace of Formula One and home of British motorsports. What a bangers and mash we had at the Stone. McLaren has a rocket ship, according to LCH, but I don't think anybody needs to remind him, Max is still Captain Kirk. Your thoughts on the race, senor?
What a great Grand Prix. I mean, that was awesome. I have to admit, I think McLaren took all the pictures of the Red Bull floor when Perez screwed up in Monaco. Well, there was a lot of information on that floor. McLaren copied everything. They did it as fast as they could. LCH even called it the Red Bull look-alike. He went to Toto and he said, "This is what we should be doing." It was awesome to see all of a sudden McLaren in the top three, top five, and it felt good. And I'm not even a McLaren fan, but it was just awesome. Except for one thing, Fernando is now being pushed back, and he needs to calm that team down because I think they got too successful too quickly, and now they're drowning in some mistakes. A lot going on here, Nasser, but this was a great race.
Yes, sir. For me, best race of the season so far. And finally, someone passed Max on the track. What a great start by both Chrome and Papaya cars. Local lad leading with authority. Oscar Piastri almost made it a McLaren 1-2. I'm a huge fan of both Oscar and Lando or any talented driver. And so it was very, very good to see. The excitement from the crowd for English chaps was impressive. The total weekend crowd was reported to be close to 500,000, like 480,000 people over the weekend. That's very, very good. And this is, of course, you know, where Formula One was born in 1950 and still crazy after all these years. Let's do a quickie on Colli. Perez out in Q1. Shocking. Working so hard to ask for Marco Machetti, which just has been delivered to Nyck de Vries. Brit boy Norris on top, LCH 4th and Max 5th. Q2, normal service restored with serious after effects of Agent Orange. Piastri 2nd and Norris 3rd, both behind the Max factor. Albon, star of the weekend, equally impressive in 4th for Williams on a track where they scored their first ever Grand Prix. Now, Q3 was tale of two cockpits. 5 pole positions in a row for Max and 5 in a row non-appearance in Q3 for Checo. Local lad was on the front row, not LCH, not Boy George, it was boy from Bristol. Bristol, England, not Bristol, Tennessee, Lando Norris. 3rd front row start for driver who won every single Theatre Championship bar one before reaching Formula 1. Only exception was Formula 2, where Norris was beaten in 2nd place by George Russell. Aussie teammate Oscar Piastri was 3rd, very impressive for a rookie and not bad for a number 2 in only his 10th F1 race. And I have a feeling that he will not be a number 2 for too long. Then we had the 2 Ferraris followed by 2 Mercedes cars, Albon sharing row 4 with LCH. Alonso qualified 9th, despite the recent machismo-ness of the team and the driver, he was still almost a second off the pace of Max, and like you said, looks like they are tumbling down. And Pierre Gasly completed the top 10. What stood out for you, senor, in Colli?
Obviously McLaren. I mean, you got to go for that right away. Max, he's sort of confused on how many different teams are right behind him at all these Grand Prix, but it's entertaining, and I was really happy for Norris and Zach Brown. I have to take back everything I said about Zach. I called him an American slob. I was wrong. Zach, keep up the good work. You're doing a good job. But no, very, very impressive. I'm sad about Aston and no Fernando's on the podium, but it's interesting. And I have to comment on the De Vries firing. This is really, I mean, De Vries firing, it was expected. Everybody knew it was coming. But it's also a big shot over Perez's Mexican bow. In other words, they got rid of De Vries like that. Checo needs to start taking some kind of, I don't know, maybe a blue pill, but he needs to perform and perform with elegance very quickly, or he is going to go El Chaparuni.
If Checo takes the blue pill, I think he will get the pole, but then Max will win the race. But as long as he's finishing on the podium, I think his job will be secured. But you never know with Red Bull. Their demands are too high. But then again, they give the opportunity to deserving drivers, and you have to take the pole, whether it's red or green or what, and run with it at the pace they want or demand. But, you know, again, I feel very bad for Nyck de Vries. He really, really did a tremendous job at Monza with the Williams, and everybody was rooting for him. And to see this happen, you know, you never want to see anybody lose a job. But he's a very talented driver. I think he will find something in sports car which is thriving, or maybe Formula E. And there's always, you know, IndyCar racing here. He is a very good driver.
Yeah, and don't forget, Tsunoda, he was sort of trying to help us with Nyck de Vries, saying a lot of it is the car. And I hate to say this, but I think Nyck de Vries did so well in the Williams because it suited him a lot better. And he struggled with the AlphaTauri. And I think Tsunoda hinted that it's really a piece of crap and it's very, very hard to drive. And he's had an advantage having been there for a couple of years. Who knows? But also, they could switch Albon and Perez. Whoop! That could be interesting. So there's a lot of people on the line already. And Max, you know what? He can't be bothered with these little problems. You know, Brad Pitt, movie making. He doesn't want to hear about it. All he wants is polishing his cabinets that are made by the former cabinet maker of LCH, thinking where he's going to put the third championship trophy in his little yacht.
Yeah, but you know, talking about car being crap, you and I both know, we know drivers who started their life in Formula One in crap cars, and that's where they really made their mark. No matter what car you're driving, a very good car, as McLaren had in 2007, or a Minardi, or a Tolman, or a whatever, you have to make an impact against your teammate. If you don't beat your teammate, then it's like, you know, it reminds me of that situation at Toro Rosso between with Antonio Liuzzi, who had a tremendous karting career, one of the most successful. He had a tremendous junior series career. I think if I remember correctly, there was a series called Euro 3000, which was before GP2, and in the last season of that series, which I believe was 2005, and I was at Imola, I think he won the first seven races, so he completely dominated that. And then Scott Speed, who had won Formula Renault Euro Cup, which in those days used to be very, very competitive, and they were teammates, and they were as good as each other. One of them had to blow away the other to be retained by Red Bull, but that did not happen, so it's performance that counts with Machete, and he likes to see, he's on the Al Davis program. The machete will fall, and it will fall hard. He will be chopped off in one attempt. Hopefully, Nyck will find something. Okay, sir, moving on to the Grand Prix. We all knew who was going to win the race, but the action behind was intense. Number 44 chasing number 14, and I'm sure you were loving that. The top nine were within 1 second on lap 5 when Max took the lead and started doing with immediate effect what he does best. No more pull up to my bumper. This, to borrow a phrase from Miss Kelly LeBrock, is essence of man. And what does the man on the left coast say about the start? And Racer, you already mentioned your favorite, your new favorite, Brad Pitt.
That whole Brad Pitt thing is hilarious. I don't know why he's pawning himself off as a driver, because I think the guy is 55 years old. Anyway, the start was magnificent. By the way, Max is still having a full investigation on why he had wheel spin and a bad start. But boy, those McLaren boys, they were just so hungry for some love. And they went for it, and it was exciting. It was great battling, and you could see remnants of Lewis Hamilton against Max a few years ago. And now it's Max against his buddy Lando. They're really good friends. It was awesome. I'm telling you, you can't make this up.
No, it was fantastic. On lap 7, the crowd was in seventh heaven and reached out for more fish and chips as LCH did a catch-up and passed Machismo for 7th. Now, what could be better than that in jolly old England? At this stage of the race, George Russell in fifth was the only driver on soft. Rest were on medium. Lap 10, Esteban Ocon became the first retirement of the race. And it's just my thanking, Mr. Rogers. Alpine's L plan. You know, they've had this for a few years. I think it's being renewed every 5 years. I think it's time for another one. Lap 20, Max had a 4 second lead over Lando. Sainz in fifth was the only Ferrari in top 10. Perez was 9th and Albon doing a great job in 10th. You know what kind of surprised me in this race? That even with the DRS, drivers were having a difficulty in passing. But we've seen this situation before also. George Russell did 29 laps of the 52-lap race on soft tires before going out on mediums and came out in 9th. Not a fast pit stop at 3.9 seconds. But on lap 31, he did a great pass on the outside of Leclerc at Luffield to move into 8th. Must be said, Charles was on hard tires. Lap 33, we have a K-Mac Cablamo Ferrari engine on fire, not the way they wanted. Then we have a safety car, and I was thinking of you, Mr. Rogers. A lucky strike for you-know-who. Jawohl, Lewis Hamilton. Lucky when he is winning, lucky when he is not winning. He comes out in third on softs, ahead of Piastri, but behind Lando on hard tires. Lando's, this was the funniest moment during the race for me. Lando's comment was lovely when told LCH on softs. Did you think it was amusing, sir?
This is the stuff I live for. Leave me alone. I know what I'm doing.
Yes. Green means go on lap 39. At the top, business as usual. Max, the monster mash on soft tires. Within a lap, he was 2 seconds ahead of a delightful dogfight, which I really enjoyed between Norris and Hamilton. LCH, despite having DRS and soft tires, was unable to pass fellow Brit. And you know, Mr. Rogers, in a race, at least for me, speaking strictly for myself, when you have a battle like this for a few laps and some other actions we were seeing, for me, that's a great race. You don't need 50 passes for a great race. What say you?
I completely agree. It was awesome, especially the frustration. And not only that, but you have to think about Toto in the office, you know, staring at the screen, watching a customer car ahead of LCH. Not just a Mercedes, but an LCH Mercedes. And it's tough to take. But he's, you know, he's being a man. He's already said that they're going to start focusing on the 2024 car. And W14 is going to be sent to the Toyota Museum.
Oh, boy, not to the Trabant Museum?
Exactly.
You know, he called the 2013 Mercedes Diva 2.0. I'm serious. Let's hope they don't have a hat-trick of Divas. Otherwise, LCH is going to be really... P.O. Okay, lap 44, Checo passes Carlito for 7th. Lap 46, Gasly out with suspension issues. And lap 47, Checo passes Machismo for 6th. Did that hurt your feeling?
No, I'm okay. I could tell Machismo not having a great weekend. I think he's going to make up for it in Hungary during our 2-week summer vacation while they fire people and hire people.
Okay, 5 laps to go, Max was 3 seconds ahead of Norris, who was 2 seconds ahead of Hamilton. Dogfight continued on the final lap as Leclerc tried every which way to pass Albon for 8th, but was denied by the Williams driver. So very, very impressive performance from Mr. Alex. Max is now marching to his 3rd successive title with 8th victory of the season from 10 races. First British Grand Prix win for him. He previously won the 70th anniversary Grand Prix at Silverstone in 2020. Sunday's victory was 6 in a row. He is the 5th driver in the history of Formula One to achieve this feat. He will be hungry for more in the next race in Budapest. Win also matches McLaren's 11 wins in a row from the halcyon days of Honda, Senna and Prost. And Mr. Rogers, the way this guy is going and the Red Bull package is going, you know, last year he won 15 races at a new track record. I have a very strong feeling he's going to have more than 15 wins this season. And they are saying the earliest he can capture the championship is Singapore. What say you?
It's pretty impressive, but yeah, it's full domination. I agree. It's the Dolphins 1976 all over again, Nasser.
Lando Norris second and Lewis third. First time since 1999 that two British drivers on the podium in their home Grand Prix. Back then it was DC, David Coulthard and Eddie Irvine, and this was the race in which Michael Schumacher broke his leg.
Hello everyone, I am Jose Maria Lopez from Argentina. Congratulations to the Formula One Weekly on the 1000 podcast.
Any more comments on the race from you before we look at the Drivers' Championship?
Well, you know, the Drivers' Championship, we know what's going on there, but it was a very good British Grand Prix, good attendance. It was a good F1 success story. And Max, you know, he's really not the conversation anymore. They're going to give him all the races. But what's happening behind and what's going to happen next year is fascinating. Everybody is slowly taking steps forward, a few steps back, a few steps forward. So we're going to see, does Mercedes get left out? Do they just give up completely as McLaren are surging? And I'm hoping that Aston can make a few steps forward. Alpine, I don't know. They're quick sometimes, but they just can never put it together. And all focus is on Checo, another Grand Prix with a failed qualifying. He needs to be on the front row in Hungary or it's over. I say over.
Yes, you know, I think pretty soon all the cars will look like the Red Bull.
There's no doubt. After what McLaren did, everybody's going Red Bull look-alike all the way.
Yes, interesting. But the paint scheme on the McLaren looked very good on TV, I must say, the chrome and papaya. Did you like that?
I did like that. Chrome and papaya is always good in the morning.
Yeah, and the Ferrari car is beautiful. The Aston Martin green looks good. But we do need some oomph from all these teams, so we have some more competition at the front. Okay, so looking at the championship, Max on top with 255 points over teammate Perez on 156. That is a 99-point lead after 10 races. This is called smashing the piñata ruthlessly. Machismo is tercero with 137 points, but somebody is getting too close for comfort with 121 points. Who could that be? Casper the Friendly Ghost from 2007 saison. Si, senor. Fifth in the championship is the hombre who won at Silverstone last year, Carlos Sainz Jr. with 83 points, 1 point ahead of George Russell in sixth. L is for Leclerc, Lance, and Lando. They are 7th, 8th, and 9th, respectively. Ocon completes the top 10 with 31 points. Two drivers remain pointless, Logan Sargeant and Nyck de Vries. The pressure is off Nyck, as he will not be racing at the Hungaro Ring. That place has been like the house of the rising sun. It's been the ruin of many a poor boy. And Lord, I know one. And we don't want to mention the name here. Any comments on the top 10, sir?
No, I expected that. The only thing is Ferrari keeps, they perform and then they don't perform. It's a mess over there. I'm not sure quite what's going on. And the strategies were interesting to watch. There were some mistakes made. But in the end, it was a great Grand Prix. I'm happy for Lando, Piastri, even for Fernando. Seventh isn't that bad. They're still getting good points. They're getting what they need, but McLaren are the ones to watch now.
Okay, sir. We are going to move on now to the Constructors' Championship. Red Bull Uber Alles with 411 points. Mercedes, this is very interesting, Mr. Rogers. Mercedes second on 203 points. In other words, Mercedes team has less points than the Red Bull Matador. Aston Martin third, 181 points. 137 of these points coming from one driver. Wonder who could that be? Just a hint, it's not Daddy's little Jim Clark. Ferrari is fourth with 157 and McLaren completes top five with 59. So of course, the championship for the driver and constructor is pretty much a done deal. Okay, sir, moving on. And Williams, how nice to see two legacy teams do well. Their glory days are long gone, but it was very, very pleasing and heartwarming to see them do well. Hopefully we will see McLaren and Williams win again on a regular basis in our lifetime. And like you mentioned, you're not a McLaren fan. I think most racing fans whether they are McLaren fan or not, or Williams or Ferrari, they all want to see these teams do well. They're such an integral part of motor racing. And Albon finishing ahead of two Ferraris. Wow. Is this the dawning of the age of Aquarius? There must be some serious hair pulling at the Prancing Horse stable over this. Albon is now being linked to a seat at Ferrari. Charles Leclerc has nowhere to run, nowhere to hide. But I get the impression, and tell me if you agree with this, Carlos Sainz's paella dishes are done at Maranello. And I have a very strong feeling, this is mostly based on reports and his really communication, that he will be seeking new pastures in the near future. What say you?
Yeah, I get the same feeling too. I mean, even some of the comments between his team on the radio, he's lost complete interest in Ferrari. I think it's just a little too chaotic over there, and Carlos works better with a well-managed team as he did at McLaren. So I don't know, but he's very, very fast, and sometimes faster than Leclerc. So he's a great driver. He will find another seat, but it is a little, Ferrari's a little weird, and Albon should be careful for what he wishes for.
Yeah, you know, his stock is rising, and you know, there's a possibility he may be traded on the Red Bull or Scuderia Ferrari exchange. Word to the wise and fast high. Do not, and I repeat, do not become teammate to Max again. Once is enough. Those who do not learn from history are condemned to repeat it. Because if you sign a contract as teammate to Senna, Schumacher, Hamilton, and Max, the championship dreams will evaporate, disappear, and check out before the ink is dry. And that, unfortunately, is the sad reality of motor racing. Okay, another aspect of the race was different tires being used towards the end of the race, which was very interesting. Drivers on soft could not pass drivers on hard tires, and this included LCH. He was unable to take second from Lando on harder tires. Did that surprise you?
It did surprise me, but once again, Silverstone is interesting, a little cloud cover, everything changes, grip changes, and Pirelli's tires change so often. That's why the drivers hate Pirelli. Yeah, very bizarre. And the softs dropped off quicker at the end of the race than they did at the beginning of the race. There's a lot to take in. Trust me, a lot of data here. Interesting.
And George Russell did a very good job going such a long stint on soft tires because, you know, at the beginning of the race, you have full fuel load. So how he do that, I don't know. Now let's look at some silver linings at Silverstone for some. Red Bull and Max's immaculate season continues. 10 wins from 10 races for the team. And 8 victories for the Dutch machismo. This was Max's 150th start for Red Bull, and we don't need to check with Daniel Kvyat to know what happened in Max's first race for the team. One word defines that moment: torpedo. Did somebody say karma? LCH, driver you call "What's up, my brother?" is the dominator at Silverstone. 8 Grand Prix wins, 3 second place finishes, 3 third place finishes. Meaning he has been on the podium in 77% of the Formula One races he has competed in at Silverstone. The only better record than this is, I think, Sebastian Vettel won all 3 Indian Grand Prix. But to compete in a race, 12, 13, more than 10 races and have this performance is very impressive. Williams, Frank, Patrick, and that great talent spotter Claire are all gone. But the legacy of Sir Frank lives on in the now American-owned team. Even though this was the 799 Grand Prix, they celebrated the 800 Grand Prix here on home track as the race in Imola was cancelled. Silverstone is the track where Swiss driver Clara Gazzoni gave Frank Williams his first Grand Prix win in 1979. A race I listened to live commentary on BBC World Service, and I distinctly remember the commentator screaming, "We have a tragedy," as the race leader in the other Williams, Alan Jones, suffered a turn blowed up. Next, we come to an Oscar moment, Signor Piastri. A star is reborn. This young man from Melbourne, Australia, won anything and everything on his way to paradise. That is Formula Uno. There would have been 2 McLaren drivers on the podium had it not been for safety car, but Piastri has made his mark. After the race, he said he is happy to be disappointed in 4th. Interesting comment. This is a special talent. If Zach Brown and his boys keep up the good work, they did on Sunday at Silverstone. Oscar will pretty soon let Lando know the penal colony is now the performance colony. In the palatial studios of F1 Weekly, we always welcome cage rattling, no matter what corner of the world is coming from. Your thoughts on Piastri's performance, sir?
It was good. It was impressive. I mean, once the car was a rocket ship, he handled it well. I don't know. You know, Norris is a pretty talented young man. His manager was caught having a meeting with Dr. Marco. So there is movement. Things are fluid. We'll see what happens. Is Piastri going to scare Lando to go to another team right when McLaren is peaking? I don't think so. So it's going to be good. And we do like cage rattling. And of course, cage rattling equals entertainment. So I'm hoping that Piastri starts nipping at his heels.
Yeah, that'll be interesting. Okay, sir, now let's look at some support races, feeder series as they call them, Formula 2. Sprint race, Misty and Vesti. Mercedes Junior from Denmark, Frederik Vesti was the winner, leading from pole to checkered flag. Sauber Junior and your fellow Francais Theo Pourchaire was second, and Alpine Junior from Australia, Mick Doohan, was third man on the podium. Feature race on Sunday was won by French driver Victor Martin despite a 5-second penalty, which was very impressive because the heat was on in the closing stages for him to get this gap done, and he did. Zane Maloney, known as Boy from Barbados, was second with Theo Pourchaire third and Jack Doohan fourth. In the championship, Vesti leads with 135 points and he's part of the Toto Wolff pack. Pourchaire is second on 129. And Ayumu Iwasa from Japan, part of the Red Bull / Honda, is third, very impressive, with 111 points. Formula 3, case of mellow yellow for Montoya. Sebastian Montoya dominated the race but was put in a spin at the end of yellow flag on lap 12 of 18. Victory went to Franco Colapinto of Argentina, Gabriel Bortoleto was second, and Christian Mansell third. Mini Monti was classified 8th. Sunday's feature race winner was German Oliver Goethe. His Trident teammate Leonardo Fornaroli was 2nd. Josep Marti from Spain was 3rd. In the championship, Brazilian Gabriel Bortoleto leads with 128 points. Josep Marti is 2nd, 92 points. And Sicilian Gabriel Mini 3rd with 77 points. And sir, speaking of Sicilian Gabriel Mini, he is managed by Nicola Turz, all road management, and you know my friend Olivier worked there. So I sent him an email this week, or I think it was, earlier today, and that if he could set up a Skype interview with this kid. And he responded that I need to submit, as per requirement of, since he's in the Alpine Driver Academy, and all these company teams do that now, that in order for them to approve the interview request, they want to see the questions first. So I prepared the questions, I will send it to him, and hopefully we will get it done, an interview by Skype with Josep Marti as soon as possible.
Hi, I'm Lindsay Brewer. Congratulations to F1 Weekly for 1,000 podcasts.
Okay, and sir, there is another new series. This is what amazes me about motor racing. You know, good times, bad time, new series are coming all the time. It's happening in Europe, it's happening here in the U.S., so now they have this Formula 4 in Europe. So now they have started a series. It's, I think, like a three-round series with three races each called Euro 4. And they're using the Formula 4 cars. And they were racing in Italy. And this American kid we interviewed a few weeks ago, Ugo Chukwu, he won two of the races. So keep up the good work to him, and very impressively done. Okay, sir, now we come to our final segment, my favorite segment for today. Great moments. Let's talk about motorsports moments which stand out for you in the time we have been doing the podcast. And please mention three moments that do not involve Alonso, Fernando, and Nando.
Well, you have to talk about Fernando because he is el machismo in the past 20 years. His drive at Imola 2005, beating Schumacher. And don't get me wrong, the next year Schumacher comes back in a vengeance. But, you know, the Schumacher era, the Fernando beginning, was a big part of the F1 Weekly world. And it was part of our motivation. It's a great drive.
It was more than a great drive. Totally agree with you for once. And what I remember about this race, for whatever reason, it was not televised live in the U.S., and I was following on F1's, Formula One's website, you know, text or whatever it's called, and I was like 100% sure that sooner or later Michael Schumacher will pass him because he was such a big name. But Machismo, young Machismo held him back. So that was very, very impressive. And we've mentioned this race many, many times, very deservedly so. What else stands out for you, sir?
For me, another great one, and it was just unbelievable to watch this, is 1996, Schumacher's first win in the rain, Barcelona. It's coming down, and he is El Machismo. I mean, there is no doubt about it. This is a fantastic race to watch on YouTube. Definitely one of my favorites. And indeed, Villeneuve for me on pole position after winning the Indy 500 the year before blew my mind. I just went, whoa, we've got what we call here talent. So it was exciting. Unfortunately, he didn't win the race. But yeah, those are historical moments. Just stick in your brain. And that's the story I'm going to stick to, Nasser.
Yes, you know, fantastic choices. The 1996 Spanish Grand Prix. I was flying from Cali to Brooklyn, New York, and so I missed the race. And I had requested my friend to call me and to give me the results. So he called me, and he says to me, "Schumacher won. It was in the rain, and it was like a Senna-like performance." So I just knew he totally dominated, so no need to watch the race. And I only watched this race, I think it was late last year. And this performance is absolutely mind-blowing. You know, the guy is running fourth or fifth, and he took his time to pass one driver, then another driver. But man, once he passed, he was checked out. I mean, long gone. It was very, very impressive. And you know, as a lifelong fan, very passionate like you about Formula One, I remember distinctly where I was when I got the news. I was in the kitchen of my San Diego apartment, and I got the news that Jacques Villeneuve has taken pole position on debut, which very few people have done, and I was freeze-framed for a minute. So these are very, very important moments of major racing. And sir, if I may share my... For me, the thing that will really stand out, I don't know if it happened before we started podcasting, but it was in that area. The moment was when Michael Schumacher, the totally committed, super, uber professional driver, breaking down in press conference and asked what it means to match Ayrton Senna's record of pole positions. And Mr. Murray would say, "I have a lump in my throat even now." That was a moment I will never, ever forget. Then, watching with my own eyes, a teenager winning a Grand Prix on debut in 2016 with Red Bull in Barcelona was unbelievable. But what has happened since then, it's not very easy to understand. And sir, finally, French pride and Canal Plus. Pierre Gasly's magical moment at Monza was captured on the final lap by French commentator, I believe his name is Julien Fabreau, in a manner that can only come from the heart. He counted the years, of course all in French, he counted the years, months, and days to the last French victory, which was Olivier Panis in Monte Carlo in 1996, which was all fine and dandy. But man, when he started taking names of French drivers who won Formula One races, that really got very, very deep under my skin, as I'm very familiar with all of these names. Take a listen. This is also today's musical mondial.
La ligne droite est plus courte que la première, il est un peu loin. DRS ouvert, l'accélération vers Ascari, ce sera pas avant Ascari, ça ne peut qu'être après la chicane d'Ascari, il faut encore tenir. Allez Pierre, il faut tenir jusque dans les derniers instants. Il reste la parabolique tout au bout là-bas, elle est loin, elle est infiniment loin cette parabolique. Écarte-toi, ne le laisse pas t'aspirer. Il se met à l'intérieur, il fait de la récupération d'énergie pour essayer de sortir de la parabolique. Elle est presque là, elle est presque là, cette victoire. Accélère, accélère. Oui, il va aller la chercher. Ne lâche pas. La victoire de Pierre Gasly, il l'a fait. Victoire de Pierre Gasly, victoire d'AlphaTauri, la victoire française. 24 ans, 3 mois et 18 jours après Olivier Panis, la France de nouveau victorieuse en Formule 1. Il l'a fait, Pierre Gasly. Exceptionnel. Victoire historique. Pierre Gasly, vainqueur du Grand Prix d'Italie. Ah, il y a de la déception, bien sûr, chez McLaren. Écoutez ces noms. Trintignant, Sever, Beltoise, Lafitte, Depailler, Jabouille, Arnoux, Pironi, Prost, Tambay, allez-y, Panis. Et aujourd'hui, Pierre Gasly, vainqueur d'un Grand Prix de Formule 1. Oui, monsieur, oui, madame.
Okay, sir, that should do it for this historic 1000 podcast. Once again, very sincere. Heartfelt thank you to everybody who listens to us, people who have come to meet us, helped us. It is greatly, greatly appreciated. Thank you.
You don't do this all by yourself. So many people have helped. Once again, Toby Dawes, thank you. Thank you for everything you do and what you will do in the future, because I know you're hooked for life. And I even want to thank Bob from Performance Motorsports for playing our show out there in the ether. Yeah, there's just too many people. And I just want to thank everybody for listening, for contributing. Emails, if anybody wants to send us emails, please do. You know the address, and we'll read them on the next podcast. Thank you, everyone. We love you. Good night.